May it please the court, Catherine Burke on behalf of plaintiffs' appellants. With me is co-counsel and trial counsel Rosemary Orsini. I would like to reserve 3 minutes for rebuttal. Your honors, we're here because the case submitted to the jury at the end of trial in this matter was simply not the case the plaintiffs were entitled to based on the facts and the law. The errors that we're here to address denied the plaintiffs the proper measure of damages they were entitled to, and denied them the opportunity to have the jury determine whether Mr. Bowen's conduct was extreme and outrageous and whether he committed a trespass. On the extreme and outrageous claim, the issue here is that the trial court made voluminous findings of fact regarding Mr. Bowen's conduct that's laid out in the opening brief. And as at the end of that set of findings, the court found that the evidence there, his own findings, were sufficient to send a claim of punitive damages to the jury. But he also found that it was insufficient to send the emotional distress, the IED claim, as I'll abbreviate it, to the jury.
Is the test for punitive damages the same as emotional distress?
No, Your Honor. The test for willful and wanton conduct for punitive damages is a higher standard simply because it must be proven beyond a reasonable doubt.
Really? What about the nature of the extreme and outrageous conduct toward itself, that the conduct must be outrageous regardless of a burden of proof? It must be something which the crowd would scream outrageous.
Well, I would point your honor to the Churchy versus Adolph Coors case, and at footnote 7 in that case, they specifically stated that the tests are actually similar on their faces other than the burden of proof. And there's also a quote, this is from an Alaska case, but the common law is going to be similar. This is the Mitchell case, 27 P 3rd 309. And at page 312, that court stated, the offense of conduct warranting punitive damages is similar to the conduct that would sustain extreme and outrageous conduct claim.
Well, were any punitive damages awarded?
No, sir.
Well, perhaps that's because the jury didn't think there was any willful and wanton conduct. So what's the harm?
The harm, Your Honor, is that an entire claim was thrown out, the IED claim. So the jury determined that the punitive damages weren't warranted on the facts, although there may be other reasons, and that were some of those instructional errors that we also have raised here.
Well,
but they didn't have the opportunity, I'm sorry, to consider the extreme and outrageous conduct claim as it is with its own elements.
As I understand the facts of this case, the only non-economic damages you spoke about were emotional distress damages. Is that right?
Well, I guess it depends on what you mean by spoke about. There was a lot of argument and for example, from counsel about emotional distress. However, there was also argument about other forms of non-economic damages.
Well, I guess the point that I'm trying to get to is this. Leaving aside for the moment emotional distress damages, how were you prevented from putting on evidence that these dogs had a higher value than similar dogs?
It wasn't a matter, Your Honor, of being prevented from putting on the evidence. It was a matter of the jury being prevented from considering that evidence. Because when they were instructed, and I'd especially point to instruction number 2, which was supposed to be the statement of the case instruction, but the way it was formatted, it appeared that the jury was being instructed specifically to stick to the market value. And in fact, they sent out a question during deliberation specifically that says, they said in their question, instruction 2 tells us that we can only give the market value. So it wasn't an evidentiary problem, it was the jury's ability to consider the evidence.
Once again, my question goes exactly to that point. What would prevent you from, for example, putting on an expert from the American Kennel Club, saying that the market value of these dogs was far higher than similar dogs that might be owned by other people in the neighborhood?
Well, as I understand your question, Your Honor, what you'd be talking about there is value related to pedigree, for example. And some of these dogs were not pedigree dogs. These were dogs that had been, I can't tell you exactly where they came from, but at least Doc, for example, I believe was not a purchased at a breeder for a high price pedigree type of dog. So the Kennel Club example is going to only that what I think is meant by the term market value, whereas what we're arguing for is this broader actual value test that a person from the Kennel Club couldn't necessarily speak to, because it would speak to that dog in that family and that owner and the factors that we laid out for that test.
Is that any different than your emotional attachment to a dog?
Well, nine states believe it is. Let me pull out my... six states have expressly applied this actual value test. Alaska, Texas, New York, Kansas, Illinois, and Washington. Three other states I know have discussed it with approval, although I'm not sure if they've adopted it or not, and that's Florida, New Jersey, and Vermont. Not a single one of those states includes sentimental value or emotional attachment as part of the test. They have other factors. And most of those states expressly say, we don't want to hear about sentimental value.
But let me ask you, Ms. Burke, you've talked about, and I'm picking up on Judge Graham's question, in the briefs now, we're reading that you are suggesting you were seeking damages for loss of companionship, security, and business reputation, I gather. I guess I'm troubled by this. So let's assume, for argument's sake, we were to adopt this actual value test as opposed to fair market value. Where is the evidence? And I think, two questions. I think those three things are what you're saying was in actual value that the jury couldn't consider. One question is, how was the jury prevented from that? Second question is, what evidence did you put on of any of those things?
Well, Your Honor, the jury was prevented specifically by the instructional errors, and again back to instruction 2, which they interpreted to mean that they were limited to the market value, and then instructions 20 through 20.
Well, did they really, excuse me for interrupting, but on instruction 2, because you said this now a couple times, I guess I'm not sure how it limited them to fair market value. They asked a question. The judge said, here's the instruction I propose, and at trial you all said that's fine. Where's the problem? How is that not invited error at a minimum?
Well, Your Honor, in our reply brief, we thoroughly went through where the objections were made and at what point in time. Numerous objections to the instructions were made off the record during the informal conference ahead of the finalization of the instructions, and then were again put on the record afterwards. And within those arguments included arguments that the value of the dogs was broader than the market value. And if you look at instruction 2, the very last sentence, which is separated format-wise from the rest, says, plaintiff's damages, if any, are limited to the market value of their dogs. The attorneys understand that instruction 2 was meant to be a statement of the case and that that's the defendant's position, but the jury clearly didn't understand that. And then the only option available at that point was to send the jury back to instructions 20 through 22, which defined economic loss to include the cost of the dogs. So there was no place left by that point after the arguments were done and after the instructions were finalized to include anything other than, quote, market value or, quote, cost.
Well, the instructions conference, I assume, was towards the end of the case, and I understand what you're saying. It was off the record.
Yes.
Right. Did you have any sense that you couldn't put on this evidence before the trial? Was there a motion in limine or anything like that?
Well, again, Your Honor, it wasn't a matter of being prevented from putting the evidence on. It was a matter of the jury being prevented from...
But the question is, if you didn't put on any evidence of these issues, what difference does it make that the jury didn't... Okay, you can only consider fair market value, but the only evidence they had was fair market value. Where's the harm to your client if you put on no evidence of any of these things anyway?
Well, I believe we did put on the evidence, and
okay.
That's where we...
Please tell me what that is.
Okay, let me find my exact listing. This would be in the opening brief. For example, at pages 15 through 17, and these are examples of types of non-economic damages for which there was evidence that the jury could have inferred non-economic. So there was evidence that the dogs were constant and often sole companions for particularly Wyatt Eichbusch and Kathleen Sullivan, but also the two veterinarians who traveled the county in their trucks and brought their dogs along with them. Secondly, there was evidence that, again, Wyatt Eichbusch and Kathleen were often, and especially Kathleen Sullivan, traveled alone as a woman extensively in her horse trailer, and that her dogs were there, so that the inference was there that they provided security. And in fact, Ms. Sullivan even testified to that when she talked about traveling alone as a woman. There was evidence provided of the time from work, and this is meant to be separate from lost profits. We're not talking about lost business income, but we're talking about what that would have done to business reputation, for example. The veterinarian clinic was completely devoted to this issue for, I think, over a week, which may have had, again, the jury could infer that that would have impact on the clients. Ms. Sullivan's self-employed and runs her business and was unable to attend to her clients and her business during an extensive period of time.
Did the veterinarians put on any evidence of how much money they lost?
They did.
One of the issues you raised in your brief was the instruction on non-economic damages. And I want to see if I understand this issue correctly. Can you get emotional distress damages on a negligence claim?
Well, Your Honor, we're not here to argue that you can. I'll put it that way. No. I'm hesitant to concede
that. Does that mean you can't?
Well, and the reason that we argued it the way we did is that there are non-economic damages other than emotional distress. I think.
I understand that. Let's assume for the moment that I may not see it. Let's just assume that. So back to the emotional
distress. Specifically emotional distress?
Can you get, do our cases suggest or hold that you can get emotional distress damages in a negligence case?
I believe that you can. I think where it gets less clear is when it has to do with destruction of property. And the issue here is whether we'd look at this in a negligence framework where we're talking about making the plaintiffs whole. For example, instruction path.
Well,
oh, I'm sorry.
Let me ask you this. So was your answer yes?
My answer is it's not clear to me
so
that you can or you can't.
To you, is it going to be clear to us?
Well, we haven't really put that.
What would you like us to do? Would you like us to say you can get emotional distress damages or not?
Yes, I think there are cases in which it would be appropriate.
Okay.
Depending on what the negligence is and what the...
Would we need to find the conduct was willful and wanton first?
Well, Your Honor, I think that for punitive damages, certainly. For emotional distress on negligence, it's not clear to me, but we haven't put that issue squarely before you.
I guess I had misunderstood your argument. I had thought your argument was, gee, you might be able to get emotional distress damages upon a showing of willful and wanton conduct. But you don't have to show willful and wanton conduct beyond reasonable doubt. I must have misunderstood.
No, well, yes.
Ms. Burke, you have 3 minutes.
I understand. Let me try to answer that question very quickly. The jury instructions conflated non-economic with punitive damages and basically told the jury that no non-economics, not just emotional distress, but non-economics without willful and wanton beyond a reasonable doubt. And our argument is that's just not legally correct, that non-economics may be available by a preponderance separate from exemplary. Okay, and I will reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Ms. Burke.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Ellis Mayer. I'm here with Allison Ayler. She and I tried the case together. I'm also here with my clients, Mr. Bowen, sitting with his wife in the front row.
Mr. Mayer, before you get going here, I know that you had filed some supplemental authority on Friday, correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
I want to remind you courteously that the notice of orals required that any supplemental authority be filed 7 days in advance of the oral argument. Was there some reason that you didn't file it 7 days before?
I apologize, Your Honor, and I didn't realize I missed that. Don't worry about it. I won't even argue that case tonight.
All right. Well, I guess I need to ask, and I meant to do this, Ms. Burke, do you feel you need any time to respond to the supplemental authority? I think it may just reiterate arguments already covered. All right. So, I don't mean to ding on you here, Mr. Mayer, but
I'm okay.
Remind you with respect in the future, please do that 7 days in advance unless the case was decided yesterday. Please
I appreciate that, Your Honor. Thank you very much.
Please proceed.
The way I look at this case is that the plaintiffs are trying to argue that they're entitled to return to the court and argue for damages that they never presented to begin with in this case. This is and always has been under Colorado law a property damage case. Under well-established law, which is Webster versus Boone, cited in the both briefs at 992 P. 2nd, 1183, the only way the plaintiff can recover the emotional distress damages that they wanted in this case is in the event that Mr. Bowen was found to have acted willful and wanton. Sir?
Beyond a reasonable doubt?
beyond a reasonable doubt.
Does Webster require a finding beyond a reasonable doubt as to that?
That was my reading of Webster, Your Honor, yes. But the jury did not find that Mr. Bowen acted willfully and wantonly, and therefore could not have awarded emotional distress damages under any set of circumstances because of that failure to find it. More importantly, what the plaintiffs put on for their emotional distress damages at the time of trial was their own claim that they were distressed at the loss of their dogs, which is a fairly universal emotional distress if you lose a pet under any set of circumstances. But they presented a witness who was a therapist for pet losses that they talked to, and I emphasize talked to, for the first time 4 years after the incidents which formed the subject of this suit, over the telephone to testify that these plaintiffs could benefit from treatment, no claim of any severe emotional distress. And the jury found, remember that there was a series of jury instructions in this case. First start with negligence, then go willful and wanton, then went emotional distress. The jury found that the plaintiff did not prove they had emotional distress, but there was an extra spot that allowed them to say how much that emotional distress would have been, and the answer is zero. And that is in the record on page 1306 to 1307.
Counsel, your opponents have argued in their briefs, based on the Creer case, as well as cases from other authority, that maybe they ought to have been allowed to have recovered damages for, if not emotional distress, the sentimental value attached to their dog.
Honestly, I look at their brief, and I thought at first they were arguing they're entitled to sentimental value, and then in the reply brief, I thought they were pretty clear that they were not claiming that they're entitled to, quote-unquote, sentimental value. At least, certainly the amicus brief was, but I didn't see that in their briefs. And maybe I misunderstood it, but certainly that is not the Colorado law that you can get sentimental value for the loss of a pet.
Well, today, I'm sorry, Judge.
We don't have any case specifically on this point, sentimental value for loss of a pet. Aren't we being, I thought we were being asked to consider adopting the law, perhaps of some other jurisdictions, on sentimental value of a pet. Now, why should or shouldn't we have such a rule?
Okay. Again, certainly I'm not asking for that. But I think I pointed out, and I didn't mean to be facetious in my brief, that allowing sentimental value for the loss of a pet would create a flurry of activity on the trial court level, certainly something that doesn't bother me, who is a trial attorney and gets paid by the hour to defend cases like this. But this is, Colorado has always been an agricultural type of society, and my understanding of the basis for why historically there's never been sentimental value for animals is because there's so many of them.
Mr. Mayor, let me ask you a slightly different question. Let's accept for a moment that the plaintiffs here are not seeking sentimental value, and as I understood Ms. Burke, at least today, I think they're seeking actual value as opposed to fair market value.
Sure.
I do think there are a lot of cases that are cited, certainly in the plaintiff's brief here, that would suggest that fair market value is the standard unless there's something special, whether companionship or a working dog or something like that, then you can look at actual value. I don't ask you to agree with that, but there are cases.
But I will agree with that.
There are cases to that. All right, so let's assume we would look at that actual value test. Ms. Burke said today in response to one of my questions and pointed me to pages 15 to 17 of her brief that lays out some evidence they put on of those other measures of damages. Now, you say they didn't argue any of this. She's pointing me to pieces of the record where she does. I guess I'd ask you to respond to her position.
And I appreciate that. Without a doubt, it's our position that for the first time on appeal, they are claiming as elements of damages things like loss of security, loss of reputation or business goodwill, those kind of things that clearly were not presented at the time of trial. Well, yes, They talk about inference in every step of the way. They never once mentioned these as elements of damages, and the court never restricted them on what they could put on for the economic losses or the value of their dogs. They chose to present evidence that they had veterinary expenses, and no objection from us, and that they had lost time from work, which I argued was mostly related to going to the legal proceedings involved in this case and shouldn't have been awarded. the jury clearly did not award them economic losses for their lost income, but they did award them the evidence that they put on and presented at trial and urged to be part of the damages. They put a lot of their eggs in the basket of emotional distress, which the jury did not get to because they didn't find willful and wanton. And when they did get to it, still found there was no emotional distress, which we believe, and you can't put your head in the minds of a juror, was based on the kind of overdoing of that evidence at the time of trial with this pet therapist who'd spoken on the phone.
So just for clarity, or make sure I understand, Mr. Mayor, so I gather you don't disagree with Ms. Burke that they put on some evidence about lost time at the, particularly the veterinarian's practice. They put on that evidence, but I think you're telling me it was in the context of economic damages.
Absolutely.
Is that right?
That's okay. Exactly right. And in terms of all the other types of damages, no one stopped them from doing that, not certainly not I, and certainly not the judge. And all they did, they're claiming inferences now looking back at the record, but if you look clearly at the record, they never presented those as a damage claim in this case.
Now, how do you respond, I don't mean to monopolize your time, I apologize. How do you respond to Ms. Burke's argument about the jury instructions, which talked about cost or fair market value?
Well, again,
now, I know there's a preservation issue. On the merits of it, though, would you respond to her argument that those instructions did prevent the jury from considering these issues?
Again, the jury considered all of the damages that they presented to them, and it was their instructions that they did not object to, ultimately, in this case. They point, it's their page 11, it shows you what how they objected to these instructions. And they kind of, every one of them is kind of a dance around argument, particularly when it comes, by the way, to burden of proof, which was never once objected to. And except they claim off the record it was objected to, I certainly do not recall any such argument off the record, and I can't believe that that Judge Crabtree in this case would have ignored that or allowed me to ignore that if that had really been raised.
Mr. Mayor?
Yes, sir.
As I read the record, the argument that the plaintiffs put on was that they had suffered emotional distress in terms of non-economic damages.
Yes.
I'm having a difficult time delineating between emotional distress and any other kind of emotional attachment to the dogs. Do you see a difference between sentimental value and emotional distress?
I do, primarily because of the circumstances under which these dogs died. I'm just going to guess you've had pets in your life. I know I've had. In fact, I had a dog die last year that lived for 14 years. It was tough, but it happens, and it causes emotional stress. But does that make it suddenly sentimental value where I start to, you know, talk about how great it was to throw the ball in the backyard and all those things, and I get some extra set of damages over and above that? I think the key to this case is that they would be entitled to emotional distress had they proved outrageous conduct or that there was willful and wanton conduct. They weren't allowed to prove outrageous conduct because the activities of my client was on his property to try to keep cattle safe.
One more question.
You bet.
Mr. Mayor, please stay by the microphone.
Oh, I apologize.
I'm sorry, Jack.
This is my tendency to kind of walk around.
As I read instruction number 2, the jury was told that the jury could award the loss of value of the dogs. And I'm struggling with what prevented the plaintiffs here from putting on evidence that the value, the fair market value, was somewhat higher for these dogs than the simple cost of the dog from a pet shop.
There was absolutely nothing that prevented that. These dogs, I'm not suggesting that the dogs didn't have value to the plaintiffs because they were their pets. Again, I have pets, I've had pets. I still think about the pets that are no longer here. But the bottom line is that we heard no evidence of their value beyond them being simple pets. I'm not suggesting we were talking with seeing eye dogs or special dogs that way, but I never heard evidence, nor could evidence have been presented, that they were special breeding dogs, that they had been bred, that they were planning on doing it. Again, nothing prevented that, but there was no evidence.
So is it your position that the term cost is not a limitation on value?
That is my position, Your Honor, but my real position is that the jury instruction that said cost was presented not or over, without the objection of the plaintiff, and in any event, in instruction number two, it was clear that they were given, the jury was given the ability to award value.
Well, let me ask you, if the jury instructions are inconsistent, if cost is a limitation on value, if that's inconsistent with value, what's the jury to do? How do we know that the jury applied the correct one?
Well, unfortunately, we never know what's in a jury's mind unless they've gone outside the scope of this, Your Honor. But
what are we to presume? You know, you've got, if you have two inconsistent instructions, are we to presume that the jury somehow figures out the correct one to apply, or are we to presume the jury would have been confused by that?
Well, I think we presume in this case, which is what we're dealing with, that they gave them exactly what they presented as evidence, which was the veterinary costs, $7,000 each to the two sets of plaintiffs that put on those veterinary costs, and $100, which is a magic weird little number that Mr. Eichbusch testified it cost him to buy them.
So are you saying that basically any instructional error was rendered harmless by the
That's exactly the
relief they had requested, sought, and got?
There is no error because it was, they got exactly what they asked for.
Are you saying any error was harmless?
Yes, Your Honor.
The relief they got is what they saw.
Yes, Your Honor, that is what I'm saying.
Mr. Mayor, you've got about 2 minutes. If I could ask you to shift gears and address the outrageous conduct claim and the trespass claim, and you may have just addressed outrageous conduct. I mean, the court took that away, those away from the jury, as I recall. Why couldn't a reasonable jury find either outrageous conduct or trespass here? And outrageous conduct, I understand there's case law that says it's got to be really, really bad. But why couldn't a reasonable jury make that finding? And on trespass, you know, there was at least one plaintiff where there was this chicken meat on his or her land as it got there. Why couldn't a reasonable jury say Mr. Bowen put into play the process that got that meat there?
Well, again, we're talking, the cases they cite to refer to rivers flowing and all that stuff. Everybody knows which direction rivers go, and if you're going to pollute a river, you know exactly where it's going to go. In this case, all Mr. Bowen did, and it is undisputed because nobody saw him throwing chicken anywhere. There was some white powder claimed to be the paraquat, no evidence of that whatsoever, even preserving that evidence. The bottom line is that the only evidence was that Mr. Bowen was acting on his own property to protect his own livestock. And getting back to the analogy between inherently dangerous activities and outrageous conduct, as you pointed out, there's lots of case law that points out they're not synonymous. And I kept thinking of an example, and that would be like mining with dynamite. An inherently dangerous activity, but not outrageous. It's just the way it's done. And there was testimony from our end, undisputed by experts, about the use of paraquat and killing coyotes on land. Thank you very much, Your
Honor. Thank you very much, Mr. Mayor.
I appreciate the venue, too.
Ms. Burke, I think you have about 2.5 minutes. 2 minutes and 7 seconds.
I'm supposed to see that. Thank you. Very quickly, at the record at page 1307, it does not say that the jury found no emotional distress. It says they found no willful and wanton conduct, no causation. So then when it asked what were the damages, they said zero. That's very different than they did not prove emotional distress. The Webster case is a big case here for several reasons. It says nothing about willful and wanton conduct. What it says is if you had an IED claim, then you can start talking about broader value of property. But there it was nuisance and trespass. Nothing, doesn't have anything to do with punitive damages. But it does recognize there as non-economic damages separate from what they call pure emotional distress. It recognized things like annoyance, loss of use of the property. In that case, the people weren't able to engage in their hobbies because they had to clean up the flood. And they recognized that as a non-economic damage. So here, again, where we're talking about loss of use of the property and the different kinds of uses that the plaintiffs had for their dogs. As far as non-economic damages being raised and argued by the plaintiffs, I point you to instruction 33, where non-economic damages are defined to include things like, I have it right here, but you'll find things beyond emotional distress. Also, the at, let's see, at 3202 to 3203 in the record. Counsel argued about the different types of non-economic damages beyond emotional distress. On the burden of proof at page 3215, counsel argued that non-economics did not require willful and wanton conduct.
Did they argue the point about not proof beyond a reasonable doubt? That's the burden of proof.
They didn't use those words, Your Honor, but when we talk about willful and wanton conduct, and the way I understand that is that in willful and wanton conduct beyond a reasonable doubt is a package.
Oh, I'm not sure that that is uniformly understood to be that way.
That's the way I would understand it, and especially within the shorthand of arguing at trial. I guess I'm out of time.
Thank you very much. We would like to thank all counsel for your briefs and arguments today. All were quite helpful to us. I want to thank Amicus as well, in this case, for their efforts. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.